It's the Full 48, Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. It is day 138 of NBA Limbo. We are days away from me not being able to say limbo anymore. We almost have actual NBA. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I feel all kinds of ways. A little excited, a little anxious, a little weird. It's just, it's new and strange and a little fraught. But we're going to have basketball back, and that's awesome. And here to help me sort through all these feelings, along with a beer, are my good friends, Zach Lowe and Rachel Nichols, as we do the third annual Drunk with Power.
Woo!
Now drunk with sirens coming outside my window here in Brooklyn. Sorry.
You're in Brooklyn, man. This is just how it's a tiki bar or it's Brooklyn. It's whatever local sound effects there are.
We are.
I like that we're going to use this podcast to help you sort through your feelings. We did the first hour on Zach's pod, so we're now all several drinks in. And this feels like we could really get to something here, Howard. I like this.
This could get very emotional, and this will be promoted as next on a very special Full 48. That will be the promos.
Yes.
So we are not in a tiki bar, which is where we were a year ago around this time in Vegas, a dark, weird tiki bar with talking, lewd, animatronic parrots. And a booth that we were sitting in that we were convinced was actually one of those Scooby-Doo booths that was going to spin around and put us in like a dungeon or something. I am at home in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. Zach is coming from, can I say, where the new Lowe Estates are located?
Not New York City.
Not New York City.
Zach, suburbs.
Zach is coming from suburbs. From somewhere in the tri-state area. And Rachel, live.
He's returned to his youth.
Rachel, live from the bubble.
Yes, live from the bubble.
Where she is snacking on bubble food. And to make sure that the listeners understand that the Drunk with Power thing is legit, I'm now opening my second beer from Svendale Brewing here in Carroll Gardens. There you go.
This is so on brand for you, Howard. I love it. I'm so pleased.
This is their, it's Annie double IPA. It's 8.5%. By the end of this podcast, I will be more incoherent than usual. This is great. So if people haven't yet dialed it up. If you haven't yet downloaded Zach Lowe's podcast, The Lowe Post, which you may have heard of on podcast platforms everywhere, we have the first hour of Drunk with Power, and this is the second hour. But as I pointed out last year as well, if you listen to this one first, then this is part one and that's part two. It doesn't really matter. Do whatever you will.
Does anything matter?
See, that's how you can tell Zach's on his multiple beer.
It's a fair question every single day now, isn't it? This is great. Welcome back, guys. I'm so happy we're able to do this again, even remotely via Zoom right now, because this is one of our favorite things. It's a blast, and I know the listeners always love it, too. So quick check-in for people who did not listen to Zach's podcast first. Rach, you're in the bubble. You're snacking on bubble food. And how have you found bubble life so far? Are you acclimating? Do you feel, because at least you're out of quarantine and you have freedom of movement, which seems important.
Some. Yes. I mean, there's still pretty limited places that we can all go. And that's true for all of us, but certainly for the media. It's surreal. Obviously, it's something that's never happened before. It's certainly an experiment in American sports, an experiment in America in general. And I think just for us who are used to sort of a rhythm of NBA life, having it be so different is still jarring, even though I'm a few weeks in. Because if you think about it, all of us have set our lives by the NBA calendar and by these sort of procedures and ways that we know things happen for decades, all three of us, right? We've done this for a long time. And, you know what's going to happen at a certain time of year. We're supposed to be at Summer League now, right? All three of us. And you know what the access to players is going to be. And you know what the rhythm of shoot around and games are going to be. Except that all of that's different here. And some of it's for good. I can go to five different NBA teams practices throughout a day, and I can talk to Chris Paul in the morning and LeBron James in the afternoon, and I can talk to John Morant, and I can, you know, it's sort of to be able to hop around and do that is something that we never get in a normal setting. But then again, players have an hour to be shooting on the court for a shoot around or something like that. And then they are hustled off because a cleaning crew has to come to sanitize every object in that room. And guys aren't even allowed to sometimes get all their shooting in that they want to, because you don't get the 3-hour Ray Allen warm-up routine here. You're on the schedule of the virus and whatever all the protocols that mandate. So it is strange and different in a sport where things being the same is one of our great comforts. And I think it's going to carry out throughout this entire experience.
Yeah. And, you know, we will be fully immersed in basketball before too long here. We're getting close. And even actually over the last several days, as the scrimmages have been televised, our Twitter streams have now started to fill up more with, you know, fun overreactions to Bol Bol. And, you know, we're it feels like basketball season again. It feels like a weird version of the preseason, like a warped, you know, other universe version of the preseason. But at least it's basketball to talk about. And by the way, we're going to get to, because this is Drunk with Power and it's a critical part of Drunk with Power, we will have Commissioner for a day where we invoke all of that power later in the podcast. But I had a couple of more serious notes I want to start off with. And that's this. The basketball has been front and center, but so has social justice, and so have players wanting to make sure that they're using the platform for that. We knew there was a lot of discussion saying on the way in, we're not sure if we should go even because we don't want to detract from this moment and this movement. But they're there. Black Lives Matter is on the court. We're seeing it on every broadcast. And we're going to see soon messages on jerseys as well. But the other interesting thing that's happened in the last week or so has been that Tobias Harris had a press conference and Jeremy Grant had a press conference where these guys, every answer was about Breonna Taylor. And they decided they were not going to answer any basketball questions. And then a couple of guys have taken it to another extent here, to another level. Rhonda Hollis-Jefferson of the Toronto Raptors actually had a little presentation to the media, I think this was yesterday, in which he said, I think he answered some basketball questions first, and then he said, one final thing. I just wanted to say, I didn't say anything. I just wanted to see how the questions were set up, what you guys wanted to ask. Some of you guys have the biggest platforms in the media and talking points, and lots of people follow you guys, so I want to challenge you all, man. We know what is going on in the world and what our focus should be. I know basketball has been missed and it's loved, but there are a lot of crazy things going on in this universe, and we need you guys along with a lot of other people to put this word out, to put this message out, that we need unity, and he goes on. So he ends with, please take this a little bit more seriously. And as a media member, I'm not offended by this in the least, but I do think it raises an interesting question for all of us, and especially for those of you like Rachel who are in the bubble, and for all of us, because we have the Zoom pressers too. How do we balance this? And how do the players best balance this? Because the three of us on this podcast right now, I think it's pretty clear anybody who's followed us know where we are on these issues. And that these are, we are not three people who stick to sports or stick to basketball and do not think that players should either. But as the season starts up again, this restart, fans are going to want to know how their teams are doing, jockeying for position and then into playoffs. And players are going to want to use the platform as they should. But I think it is a little bit of an interesting and potentially awkward balancing act here for both parties and for the fans who are listening. Rach, what you're there. What have you gathered so far from what you've seen?
I'm interested in what Zach has too. I mean, for me, I think it is a balance, right? And I would just say to Rhonda Hollis-Jefferson, I know Kyle Kuzma's talked about this too. There is a lot of media coverage of the social platforms that they're putting forward. We on The Jump have done an entire rip of sound about Breonna Taylor because players talked about that over those 24 hours. And it was important to us. We've actually spent quite a bit of time on Breonna Taylor on The Jump. And I think that it is getting through. I think that these guys sometimes don't always see everything that comes out. And I think they should be proud of the way they have put this front and center, because I think it is getting out in the media. I don't think there's anything wrong with them asking for more. And hopefully that influences more people to do more. And then it is going to be a balance throughout. The reason why there were all these cameras here in front of them is because they play basketball. So there will be some merging of basketball with these social platforms. But I'm impressed with the NBA for the way they have allowed players to integrate them in a way that, frankly, a lot of other sports leagues have been late to the party in doing. I'm impressed with the players to sticking to their guns and talking about what they want to talk about. And I think it is important anytime we talk about NBA players making these statements to point out that the WNBA players have been the ones who have largely taken the lead on this and been louder for longer than almost anyone else. And it is amazing to see their NBA brothers catching up to what they have already done, because both leagues really, it makes me proud to cover. It really does. It makes me proud to that this is the sport that I cover every day, watching these guys and listening to them. And I would just tell them that their message is getting out, because I know that those of us who talk about basketball every day, we are dedicating basically a segment a day on The Jump to it. And that is not something that we would be able to do if they weren't speaking so much. And so I hope they keep doing it.
I think part of it is just going to have to involve reading the moment, right? Like if there's an important playoff game that comes down to the last 5 minutes, I think the players are going to have to understand, and the media is going to understand, that the first X questions are going to have to be normal basketball questions. Like game 7 of a playoff series, we're going to have to ask the basketball questions. But for better or worse, the first few games, the media is going to react to what the players and the coaches do. Is there kneeling? What kind of other demonstrations are there? Those are natural ins for questions that are related to social justice and not basketball. Beyond that, I do think it is on the media. If Tobias Harris doesn't want to answer any questions about other than to say Breonna Taylor, arrest the cops, kill Breonna Taylor, other players have done that too. I think it's on the media to be prepared with interesting, relevant questions. What have you read about the case that resonates with you? What, I don't even know what they were. I haven't thought about them, but like there are ways to just have a dialogue about that like you would in your normal life if someone were talking about that case. Ask the same questions. Ask the same questions about their personal experience. Ask the questions about have they talked to anybody involved in that? Whatever it is, I do think instead of just getting frustrated and giving up, and I don't know if the media is doing that at all, I have no idea. I think you got to have some questions ready for that.
Yeah. No, I think the players are going to drive this, as they should, not because we in the media don't have a place in this, but because the media that are there to cover the basketball. But when we cover the NBA, we talk about this all the time. We're not just covering basketball. We are covering 450 players and the coaches and the executives, their lives, what they do in their personal lives. The whole reason, like we invest, fans invest all this time and emotion into these guys, not just because we care about, you know, the out of bounds play they ran in the fourth quarter of a key playoff game. Like, we're interested in them as players. And so that's why when I talk to people who are saying stick to sports, no. If you're invested in these guys, if you care about them as players, you have to care about the entire individual and the things that matter to them. And when we write about and talk about their personal lives and the things they've been through, everybody's totally receptive. And suddenly when it becomes something that they see as political or something that is a little bit more challenging, all of a sudden then people recoil. No, you have to buy into all of it. So we're part of that, and we are part of that discussion. But I don't think players should expect that beat writers who are in the bubble are going to come to those press conferences with necessarily a set of questions every day about George Floyd or Breonna Taylor or Black Lives Matter or police brutality or other societal inequities, because it starts with the basketball. And if the players want to take it there, our job is to be receptive, is to be listening, and to Zach's point, then to, yes, follow up. What is it about this case in particular that has really moved you, or that has made you, because a lot of players have left their comfort zone and decided to be activists at this time in a way that they weren't 3 months ago. So there's plenty to be written about and talked about around that. And the three of us are people who, whether in our podcasts, TV shows, our writing, I think we've done that. But I do think it's a tough one, because if a player decides to have the answer to every question basically be, today's a good day to arrest the cops who murdered Breonna Taylor, that's fine, but it puts reporters in an awkward position on how to move from there. Because I think we do want to write about those stories, and I think we do want to be supportive. Like, supportive is the wrong word. Our job is to be observers. But I think we're all, at least the three of us on this call, are engaged with that discussion. But these writers have editors who are expecting updates on, you know, who's going to be the sixth man going into the restart, or whether Zion's back from his leave of the bubble, and all these other fundamental things that, of course, readers and fans want to know about.
Well, there are players whose basketball takes on what happened in a game matter. What LeBron says about the Lakers and how they performed in the last 5 minutes of a close game matters. If you are involved on one end of a controversial call or a controversial play, what your take on what happened on the floor is matters. There are other players who are like, I don't even want to name names, but like, you don't need quotes from the fourth best player on Team X if they don't have anything unbelievably profound about the game, or they weren't involved in the crucial plays here or there. They're just there because it's their turn on the Zoom interview. I don't exactly know how it's going to work after every game. You should be able to write your story without that guy's quotes about it. It's not a huge deal if you don't get the basketball analysis you need. But I do think that's on you as a media member. Like, okay, this guy's not giving me the basketball quotes I want. Like, what are you going to do? Just give up and not write anything? File something. You watch the game. You can analyze the game. But there is a difference between that and the guys that have stature of, you know, what they say about the basketball matters. And I don't think this is that hard. Like, if LeBron is talking after a big Lakers game, I don't know how many minutes he has. Let's say he has 12 minutes. You can divvy that up and he can give you the basketball stuff you need and he can go on. Or if he decides to say nothing about basketball, guess what? You live with it and you move on and you write about the game or you write about what he said. It's not, I think the media, I don't think it's hard to follow the player's lead on this and sort of just adjust.
Yeah, I agree. I think as the games begin, especially, I think it'll all balance out. And my hope would be, look, if I were an editor who sent a reporter into the bubble or had a beat writer covering one of these teams, I would say, listen, ask the basketball questions that you need to ask. But if somebody diverts and wants to talk about social justice, run with it. And if you have to work that into the game story somewhere where it says, and, you know, though Tobias Harris hit the game-winning shot, he devoted every answer to Breonna Taylor, obviously write that. Make sure it's clear. But I do think that it has to be driven by the players. I don't know that it's up to NBA reporters to go in every day with an agenda of asking about the social justice issues. I think you have to, as we always do as reporters, you respond to the conditions around you.
I will say that LeBron gave his post-game press conference, and this was after scrimmage, obviously, the other day, and he wanted to talk about Breonna Taylor, and he wanted to talk about what became a really interesting discussion about race in America. It was extensive. It was thoughtful. To your point, Zach, the questions were thoughtful and became sort of a larger discussion that was its own really, really interesting story that people were able to write after that press conference. And especially in a moment where it's a scrimmage in the NBA restart in Orlando in July, I would much rather read LeBron's meditation on race in America as someone who is one of the most visible Black men in this country. And sort of what that means and the balance of that for him than what he did in the scrimmage that night. So I do think that there is a little bit of situational circumstances, as Zach was saying. And I think that if there is engagement by the media and the player, it can turn into really, really thoughtful discussions, because professional athletes in this country have such a unique perspective on race and what it is like to have to speak for those who don't have the same kind of voices and platforms that they do, that some really, really smart and interesting things can happen here on that topic. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, no question. I think my last thought on this is just that for the players who have decided that they're going to answer every question with an answer about Breonna Taylor, I think that there could be diminishing returns in the effectiveness of that, the impact of that. Because your first reaction, if you're a viewer watching it, I don't think anybody's watching it live, but if you're reading about it the next day, okay, oh, okay, that's interesting. But by day 10, day 20, day 50 of the restart, I think there might be diminishing returns in terms of the impact of that. And so, I don't know, I'll be interesting to see how the players calibrate that as they go. I'll be interested to see how we all handle it and certainly how the TV networks handle it. Rachel, you've already mentioned that on the jump, this is something you guys have discussed quite a bit. I would imagine both ESPN and TNT, I haven't asked the question on the TNT side. Rachel, you and Zach could maybe tell me on the ESPN side. I would imagine that the coverage plan over the next 3 months is going to include a fair amount of not just reactive, but proactive planned pieces about how players in the bubble are approaching this, how they want to use their voice, and how they hope to affect change, even as they try to pursue the championship over the next couple months.
Yeah, absolutely.
I personally think, I said this on the jump last week, I think the gestures, not the gestures, the symbolism of them kneeling would be incredibly powerful. What they say is incredibly powerful. But I'm almost more interested in how the players use the leverage of this moment to get their teams and the billionaire owners to make actual tangible commitments to the causes that matter. And so I just look at the Times just had another huge story over the weekend about voting issues in Georgia. And I look at what the Hawks are doing with State Farm Arena. Like, that's a big deal. That could be a bit, like, if you do that times 30,
that's a big deal.
And Pistons, like, players, and Kings, I think, too. Pistons, Kings.
And Bucks. And so that's already four. If you – and we're just, and the games haven't even started yet. And the players have an enormous amount of leverage by virtue of their – and they know. They know they do. And, you know, what commitments can they get cooperatively with the people on their team who have even more resources than they do? And what, like, that to me, that's an exercise of power for good. And that's really interesting. And that's a little less telegenic than kneeling for the national anthem, but the impact is, could be far, far reaching.
And that's another thing about access, right? You know, I mentioned that you have some of these professional athletes, men and women of the WNBA and NBA, who are some of the most visible Black Americans, who have the loudest voices. They also have access to some of the richest men and women in the country. NBA owners, WNBA owners, you are talking about people who are on the top 20 of the Forbes list. And that kind of money buys incredible political influence. And I have wondered and spoke to some of the players about what they do think the next step is in putting pressure on the Kentucky Attorney General to arrest the police officers who murdered Breonna Taylor. I don't know if that AG is up for re-election, but if he is, someone's donating to that campaign on one side or the other. And there are certain things that move the meter politically, and a lot of times it's money. And so they have access to these billionaires in a way that a lot of us ordinary citizens don't. And I think that if the star players say to the owner, hey, I want to sit down and have a conversation with you, and I want to ask you questions about what you're donating some of the money that you've made off me playing goes to. They don't have the right necessarily to direct where the owner should spend their money. But a lot of what happens in America is conversations between people who don't come from the same backgrounds and hopefully reaching a better understanding of each other. And that access is something that the normal Americans don't have to these billionaires. And I really hope that some of them take advantage of that as well, because I do think that that's an incredible lever in this country, is money and politics.
It's a lever they have available to them, and it's one that, like, there's another issue that was only touched upon briefly, I think, over the last couple of weeks when Kyrie and Dwight Howard were making some noise about, you know, whether we should go and whether other players should go, which is, you know, representation in the executive ranks in the NBA, Black representation in the coaching ranks at the head coach. Like, these are things they could really press at a time like this, and should, frankly. And I'll be interested to see if they voice that as well. Like, obviously, this moment is about broader societal inequities and racial justice and police brutality and a bunch of things that are much weightier than anything going on in the NBA. But this is also a moment to then hold the NBA to account. It's like, okay, great, you put Black Lives Matter on the court. That's great. And I'm not diminishing that at all. I think that's significant. And a lot of NBA owners and executives have weighed in. That's all great. But the league has its own issues to deal with. Not as pronounced as the NFL and other leagues, but still, they're there. And Zach, you brought up the potential of kneeling for the anthem. It's interesting. I've always said when Kaepernick kneeled for the anthem, and some other players in the NFL as well, and the NBA didn't, and people said, oh, see, the NBA is not as woke as they purport themselves because they have this rule in the books and players are abiding by it. My point has always been the NBA players didn't need to kneel and to have that powerful symbolic image because their league already embraces and encourages them to speak their minds and to use their voices, and they always have. And I believe that. However, kneeling is a very powerful image. And if players and coaches are going to, as has been rumored, and I think Mark Stein just had another report about it earlier tonight, that if that happens, it will, one, I think, be incredibly powerful just because of the visuals, but two, it will bring on an element that the NBA has not had to deal with before in terms of the potential backlash, although I think that is less now than it was 4 years ago.
Well, we can talk to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf if you want to. I mean, it has been an issue
30 years ago.
Still, I mean, like, no one's brought it up since. No one's done it since. And, you know, I said, and Sam Amick reported over the weekend that the NBA won't enforce the rule, or I believe that's what he reported in The Athletic. I just wish the NBA would come out and say that then, instead of sort of putting the onus on the players to push the envelope or not push the envelope. But we'll see. I mean, this is one of many reasons why the next 2+ months or whatever it is are going to be really interesting.
I'd be willing to bet, and correct me if either of you disagree, I'd be willing to bet that Adam Silver and his lieutenants have – possibly already signaled with whatever a knowing wink would be in this context, that if players and coaches are going to kneel on opening night on Thursday, it's going to be fine. It's going to be subtly sanctioned without saying so publicly.
I mean, they have done that before. I mean, a lot of the warm-up shirts that players have worn, the I Can't Breathe shirts, yes, the shoes that have, you know, gone against the uniform rules in the rule book, they have decided that they are not going to enforce those rules. And I would expect that selective enforcement at this point, too.
Yeah. All right. So a lot has gone into the planning for this bubble, and a lot of discussion and fretting and hand-wringing and all this. And I'm going to say something strange at this moment. I think this is the easy part. I think this bubble is the easy part compared to what the NBA is facing down the line. And you're both of you working for ESPN, your colleague, collective colleague, Brian Windhorst, said a story this morning about NBA teams trying to prepare for next season financially. But I don't want to get into the finances of it. But what when I say the easy part is right now, what I mean is the NBA, unlike the other leagues, all they had to do was restart. All they had to do was finish a season and do the playoffs. Now, they could have even done it quicker than they're doing it. They could have gone best of five rounds instead of best of seven. They could have not done all these, the eight seeding games. There was all kinds of ways to do this. But it's a short span. And so they have a bubble. And the other leagues have gone, Major League Baseball's having problems because no bubble. The NBA wants to restart in December, whether that's December 1st or December 20th or whatever. I don't know, as we sit here late July, that we're going to have a country ready for teams in their home markets, even without fans, in December. Rach, Zach, I'm not concerned about the next three. I'm not as concerned about the next 3 months as I once was. I think they can pull this off. I am very concerned about what the NBA could do in December and whether a real season can be started without a bubble. And if you say, well, we'll just do another bubble, well, that bubble's going to be like 7 months. And I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, they can't do a seven-month bubble. That won't happen. I mean, they just can't do this is untenable for a year or 7 or 8 months. I think everything is on the table. But I do agree with you. There's sort of just been this general assumption that, yeah, December 20th, you know, the Bulls will take off from Chicago and land in Atlanta and stay at a hotel and play at the State Farm Arena with no fans, and then they'll take off from Atlanta and fly to Dallas and play at the American Airlines Center. Could you name all 30 arenas? By the way, I think I might actually be able to.
Not after two beers.
I don't know that anyone actually. Yeah, well, you know, this is 8.2% alcohol, so it's going to be ugly by the time I have to name the, you know. Amway? Is it still the Amway Center?
At the end of this podcast,
the DeVos family compound.
At the end of this podcast, the three of us need to try to name all 30 NBA arenas.
Well, there's not 30. That's the trick.
Oh, excuse me. 29?
29. There'll be 30 soon enough if Steve Ballmer has his way.
And he will.
We should at the end say what's the worst name for an arena and the best name for an arena.
All right.
Okay.
Marketing.
Anyway.
I'm disappointed we can't include Sleep Train anymore, but continue.
Golden One Center. Okay. I think everything's on the table.
Smoothie King.
Everything between a bubble in one place and 29 NBA arenas is on the. Not everything, but I think that they've discussed. Let's put it this way: they've discussed a lot of different ideas, and they've discussed scenarios where they would be able to very easily pivot, not easily, but pivot from one idea to the other one if the coronavirus situation evolves in a way that is either good or bad. So, like for instance, instead of three East Coast road trips, would the Clippers, as an example, have one East Coast road trip that lasts a month? If there is a coronavirus outbreak in Los Angeles that is just catastrophically bad, would Clipper and Laker home games, if they are even on the schedule at that point, would they be taken off the schedule and everyone goes to play those games in Phoenix or something like that? I'm just making that up. But I think everything's on the table, but I don't think it's a guarantee. I think there's definitely hope. There's definitely hope that the scenario I described at the start with all 29 arenas being operable with no fans, there's definitely a hope that that can happen. A lot of that depends on the availability of rapid results testing, but I don't think it's a guarantee for sure.
I'm fascinated by this topic. As we were discussing earlier today what we would talk about, this was the thing I was most interested in, because it's just, it's beyond me, the idea that they could be thinking about starting training camps in November. I mean, it's hard to sit here at the end of July and think, what's going to be different? We're not doing different things in this country to make it different. But then I have to stop myself and remember that 6 months previous to now, we never could have imagined any of these scenarios. We weren't talking about any of this in January. So I just think there's a little bit, as much as someone like me who loves to know what's going to happen next and loves to play out and loves to sort of have the rhythm that we've all expected in the NBA to be back there. We don't know what the country's going to look like in November and December. We don't even know what it's going to look like in September and October. And I don't know if you mentioned baseball. I don't know if the viability of baseball and football, which is so important to this country, in fact, depending on getting some of these numbers down, is going to motivate some people in states where they have not wanted to take as collective an effort in getting down coronavirus numbers, where it has not been as much a priority. If now football is threatened, maybe some people will want to, you know, leave a little bit of the personal liberty aside and be more involved in the collective.
What a sad statement.
You know that that's true, Zach.
What a
sad
statement. Boy,
you think I'm wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I'm saying it's sad. Like, if football is imperiled, then we're talking about a whole damn.
If you think I'm wrong.
If these guys can't hit each other in their helmets and their pads for my pleasure 16 times, well, then we've got a virus. Then we've got a whole thing that we've got to deal with.
Let me know when you think I've said something that is not accurate. but I will say this, there's other, that if you go away from the 29 arena scenario, I've heard a couple different things, right? I've heard about mini bubbles, the idea of having multiple bubbles. So it's not just one bubble. You have maybe
I've heard pod,
bubbles,
pod,
right?
Instead of
pods,
bubble.
Right? Pods.
We're just getting used to bubbles. You're going to switch to pods?
You could divide by conference. You could even divide two for each conference. And the idea of doing that would be that you would allow the players' families to be there the whole time, that they would be a little bit less restrictive because you could move these guys around a little bit more because there would be less of them. We'd have the rhythm down from doing these bubbles and the bubble that we're doing now, and that it wouldn't be for the entire sort of six-month period of our current NBA season, that they'd have to make allowances for less games and maybe do half of it and then have a month break, right, where the guys go home, and then you have a whole extra ramp up with testing and everything to go into a second part of the season. You know, you could do something like that. But I do think that you have to think about, A, what the players are going to consent to, because, yes, when the idea is do you get your money or not, they might be willing to do a little more than they would, but it's still a lot to ask for them to be locked up, basically, for 3 months at a time or 6 months at a time. And then also the expense of it. That the NBA is spending reportedly between $150 and $170 million on this bubble in Orlando right now. And I hear people all the time saying, oh, they're just restarting for the money. Yes, in the long term, it is in the NBA's financial interest to have the rest of the playoffs this year and the season this year, because the viability of your league is at stake. And so, yes, they are spending the money to make the money down the road. But it's expensive to be putting this on. And Adam Silver has come out and said that it is basically a wash for them this season with the money they're spending in terms of what they're making. So there will become a point where putting on these bubbles is cost prohibitive too, if you have to do them for months and months at a time, I would assume, right?
They are expensive. There's no question. Is it a wash? I don't know if it's a wash, but it is. I mean, like the
I don't see the books. I'm just quoting the commissioner here.
Well, yeah, wash seems like a stretch. And especially if they're spending $170 to $180 million now on the bubble because they're trying to recoup the $900 million to $1 billion that they're getting from their TV money. Like they're spending to make sure that they're protecting the money that they need to come in to
defray. Well, I think Cuban came out and said at one point, you know, of course we're doing this because of the money. I mean, let's not, I do think there is a certain honor in trying to play the season out and have a champion and, you know, honor your history. And I do think, again, you know, I said on my podcast that we just did, even the epidemiologists that I talked to, dozens of them, the people most likely to look at this from a perspective of, is it safe or is it not? Almost all of them said to me, there's a intangible value in having sports. There's a spiritual value in having sports. So I do think there are other reasons, but yeah, the money is going to drive it.
The money drives it.
I just wonder if the money in the long term, like, I don't know what the money cost. My only point in bringing up the money was I don't know what it costs to do, 2 to 4 6-month bubbles. Like there is a point where the balance sheet is going
to
switch.
Well, the, what the NBA is trying to do is like, it's when you actually sit down and you're there, so you see it, you see also probably all the issues that you didn't think about and that the NBA didn't conceive of until you're actually on the ground there. What they're trying to pull off is extraordinary. And, you know, whatever it costs and all that, I mean, it's just, it's an unprecedented undertaking that is when you start to actually think about just think about the concrete steps of a player getting from outside the bubble to in the bubble and then from his hotel room to a game and back. That's like 30 pages of guidelines right there, just those things.
Yeah. No, and by no means do I want to diminish either what they have invested or the risks they've taken or the preparation they've made. Like everything they've done, it is incredibly impressive. And I am certainly more confident now on July, whatever the hell that today's date is, Monday.
who even knows? Who could say
that they're going to pull this off than I would have been weeks or months ago. And I think this is a very good chance of succeeding without the virus being an issue. I think there maybe there's more of an issue of guys having soft tissue injuries or other things from rushing back. But I think we are going to see a champion crowned in October. I think they're going to pull this off. Where the country is in October, November, December is something that I have much less confidence in with the trajectory we're on. So
I will say that I've had two different NBA players in this past few days who hail from countries other than our own tell me that they made some relatively serious inquiries about whether their country would be interested in inviting the NBA for next season, because these are countries that have managed their coronavirus problem differently than ours and have had different results than ours. Yes.
All of them except Sweden.
And
Jonas Jerebko, if Jonas Jerebko is trying to get the NBA to Sweden, it's a no-go, okay?
And Brazil. Brazil's doing pretty poorly as
right.
well. No, the New York Times...
I will say that both of these players said that these discussions never got too serious, that the NBA never actually considered that or has not yet, but that they made some efforts, Howard. They made some efforts.
I'll just say this. If the NBA wants to do a full bubble season in New Zealand, I'm in. New Zealand has handled the virus better than anybody on earth, it would appear. I've never been to New Zealand. It looks incredible. I've always wanted to go. If the NBA wants to relocate there for 6 months, I'll bring my wife and daughter. We'll just go. Like, I'm fine. That's good. Like, NBA in New Zealand.
You don't need a bubble in New Zealand. They don't.
It is the bubble.
New Zealand is the bubble.
Yeah.
You can just live your life there.
Are you just a Lord of the Rings nerd? Do you just want to go see where Frodo...
I am a Lord of the, I am a Lord of the Rings nerd, and in fact, I will have you know, Zach Lowe, that I was digging through some boxes behind those curtains, those ugly curtains you see behind me. I was digging through some boxes trying to find something the other day. You don't want to know what's behind those curtains, but I found a lot of stuff from my past, a lot of things. But I also found my original copy from the 1980s of Fellowship of the Ring. When I was first reading that as a youngster, which I then passed on to my daughter Talia to read, and we're gonna that is among the binges that we have not done yet. We got to get to the rings.
First of all, what other things from your past are behind the curtain? Second of all, only old people say youngster. You just telegraphed yourself as an old person.
I mean.
I think Howard is the oldest of the three of us.
I'm easily the oldest of the three of us. But let me just point this out, that while I shaved off the lockdown beard, which was getting really, really unruly and scary and had a lot more gray in it, while you guys can still see a little gray here on the chin, it is nothing compared to the gray in LeBron James's beard that I've seen since they got to the bubble. And I got a lot of years on LeBron, so I'm just going to say, like, I'm proud of the fact that I do not have quite as much gray going on in my beard as LeBron.
That thing is majestic. I love LeBron's beard. I hope he keeps it the entire time. It's the multicolor effect is fantastic. I love everything about LeBron's beard.
Absolutely. I'm all in on it. All right. This is the Drunk with Power podcast, so we should be drunk with power. I actually did something I never do, guys. I pulled up my podcast from last July and listened because I couldn't remember what all we covered. I actually cataloged all the things that we did. So the premise of this, for listeners who may have forgotten or not be aware, the idea was, if you're commish for a day, but you're not commish for a day, you're more like NBA God for a day. The union, the other owners, nobody matters. You could just impose by fiat whatever rule you wanted. And that was the discussion we had last year. So Zach opened it up last year by saying, shave 20 games off the schedule. Boom, gone.
I did? I said that?
Yes, you did.
You were several tiki glasses in it.
In the tiki bar where you were drinking weak beer while Rach and I were drinking like much more sophisticated drinks. You said shave 20 games off the schedule, to which Rach said, well, wait, hold on a sec. Then we're going to have other inequities within the competitively. So we got to eliminate conferences, which then led to, fine, Zach says, let's just go 1-16 right now. And then,
which, by the way, I've reversed course on. I've done a 180 on the 1-16.
Really? Why?
Yeah. I think, not a 180, but I think I underestimated the value of the what it means when a team plays another team multiple times in a postseason. The rivalry factor.
I've been talking to.
Of Bulls Pistons and, you know, Pacers Knicks and all of that. So I've leaving aside the travel issues and that it's a blood issue for all the coastal teams and all of that. I think in my zeal to punish the craven Eastern Conference owners who could not think past their pathetic teams getting two home games in the playoffs, I think I overlooked the rivalry factor a little bit.
So that was how we kicked off last year's Drunk with Power. And then we went to award reform, big pet issue of Rachel Nichols.
No
positions for all NBA, which I agree. and her most outstanding season to go with MVP, because we want to know what the true top five of the era was or of a year was. And we ended up with like 23 items on this.
Any of them happened, Howard?
I don't think any of these have happened yet. No, but you know, doesn't mean we can't keep hoping. I wanted Adam Silver to have a ceremonial burning of the tampering rules because they're irrelevant, and instead he decided to create new anti-tampering strictures. Zach at one point said on last year's pod, I want a public shaming of coaches who get up and clap or yell to try to distract shooters. And I suggested this should become a regular segment on a nationally televised studio NBA show. And you guys said we can do that. Did you end up doing that?
I don't know if we did, Zach. We got to pick up the pace there on the jump.
Rachel only lets me on the jump like once a week. And so there isn't enough time for me to build what I would say is a trademark segment. Other than Zach's NBA dreams, which, by the way, we're overdue.
We have a couple Zach Lowe trademark segments. Zach's NBA Dreams is my favorite jump segment possibly we have. Certainly my favorite Zach Lowe segment, because they're fantastic.
Well, we have one that we haven't done yet.
I know. This is, you got to get our graphics guys on it, because the visuals with it, where they sort of show what Zach's
dream
would be.
It's the best. This is the best one ever. This dream that we haven't done yet is the best dream, the best NBA dream I've ever had.
Now I'm intrigued.
It's a good one. Windhorst is prominently involved. That's all I'm going to say.
Is he Windhorst or is he a wind horse?
No, he's Windhorst.
We also have, Zach has several segments where he has the bandwagon segment. We've had Pascal segments for you. We try to incorporate all your pet issues into our jump coverage. But yes, I think the public shaming of the coaches is a Orlando seeding game project for us, Zach.
So I just,
I'm in. Some of the offenders are not in Orlando though.
I will say this, that in Orlando, I don't know what's coming across quite on the broadcast so far of the scrimmages. I can say that when you're in the building, they play music for most of it, right? Which is kind of in line with an NBA game. They are not piping crowd noise into the arena. I do think that they're putting some crowd noise on the broadcast, but I don't know to what degree. Some of the teams have been better than others at actually providing crowd noise. A couple of the benches and sort of organizations have clearly made it an issue to provide some energy for their team. And so there's a Lakers-Mavs game the other night where both benches were crazy into it, and you were getting decent crowd noise just from the like 100 people who were actually in the building. The thing that is eerie though is that they cut the music and sound at the free throw line. And to your point, Zach, about opposing coaches trying to heckle players, JJ Redick told me, he said, it's so freaky that he's taking these shots. And he said, even when I was at Duke, you'd have the home section of the fans shushing each other. But he's like, there's some other team out there. There's Maryland fans or some other fan that's there screaming at him just when he makes his release. And he said it was so jarring to have it be absolutely silent when he was at the foul line. They were playing the Nets and he was basically asking Jamal Crawford to heckle him because he needed something while he was shooting. So maybe those coaches are doing the Lord's work, Zach. I don't know.
Interesting.
Zach has no quarter. He's no interest in that.
I haven't considered that. And I actually think as soon as I'm done with this sentence, I'll continue not considering it.
Rich, can you actually explain this? This reminds me. Taylor Rooks from Bleacher Report tweeted out a photo, maybe it was yesterday, where one of the arenas, it was pregame, somebody was warming up, and in the background I could see all the virtual fans, not cardboard cutouts, but like videos of people, whatever. But I've not seen that in some of the other shots that I've seen. So is that just in one arena? Is that going to be at every game? What the hell was I seeing? Because it's freaking weird.
My understanding is that will be at every game. Every arena has the capability for it. Every arena, and there's three of them here, and they're varying sizes. But every arena, the actual court, it's all, as in Hoosiers, it's all the same size. And every court is surrounded by these giant video boards that, frankly, when you're standing there at court level, it does feel like you are a character in a video game. It just has that feel to it. And on those video boards, they can put anything. So they have the team logos there at some point. The Lakers have asked that the Laker girls be on that video board at certain times. So those, they will flash on. I don't know if other teams have asked for their cheerleaders or dancers to be on. And then, yes, you will see fans. And what is cool about that is that unlike the cardboard cutouts, or we've seen in other sports in other countries, they've had stuffed animals. I will say in Japan, and I believe it's Japan or South Korea in the baseball league, one of the Asian leagues that started long before while we were in the middle of our shutdown, they used sex dolls, which apparently then they had to apologize for. But instead of any of those, the NBA is actually letting fans be part of the experience. And I do think that that's cool. And that fan engagement isn't just lip service. It's kind of cool that they will be there and they will be part of it. And we all go to arenas and have fans that we know, right? The super fans in the different arenas. And I think they will be on the video boards at different times. I have always wondered, since we've been discussing this, if you're a player like, say, Patrick Beverley, who says he feeds off the hecklers, he feeds off the haters, he does better when people are yelling at him. Are the Clippers going to try to get some of their fans to yell at him when it's their home game? Like, I don't know how this is going to work, but the fans will be involved in every game, supposedly, or at least have the opportunity to be.
I think it's going to be cool. I can't wait to watch the games.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all starved for basketball. You know, I was watching the Nuggets game last week when they started five big men, and I was like, I don't even care that this is ridiculous. Like, I'm just excited to watch these dudes play.
That was fun. Come on. That was fun, Zach.
It was fun. And I just, like, that's my point. Like, I just want to, like, this has been such a weird and, like, long time now. Like, I'm excited to watch basketball again. Real basketball.
Absolutely.
In that lineup, Bol Bol was listed as a small forward, and the idea that someone who's 7'2" could be the small anything was just delightful.
Agreed.
So in looking at our list of all the things that we proposed last year, I actually realized that two of them by me almost had a chance of one of them had a chance of happening. I proposed best of five, return to the best of five first round, which the NBA could have done in the restart for efficiency purposes, but did not. Sad.
Well, of course they could have done. You could do it. You could do anything.
I'm just saying.
Adam Silver.
This was an opportunity.
The other way to interpret what you said is Adam Silver, when presented with your idea, smacked it down emphatically as dumb. Although I actually think best of five is a good idea, but
It's not the first time the league has scoffed at things that I have said in my 23 years of covering the league. But one of my other ones was to ban the cha-cha slide, which now that they're in an arena with no fans, there's no reason for the stupid cha-cha slide. So maybe we'll go 3 months with no freaking cha-cha slide. I may get my wish. How about that, Zach Lowe?
I am an opponent of the cha-cha slide. It was one of my first 10 things columns ever was the cha-cha slide was, if I was going to end up in an insane asylum, it was going to be because I was going to be repeating everybody clap your hands over and over again 100 times. I actually think it's cool. I think I tweeted this once. I wondered if you could like if you could give me an audio, you know, the site Sporkle where they have those fill in the blank.
I love it.
Quizzes. Mm-hmm. If you could give me like an audio version of that and you just played like a sound effect and I had to guess what NBA arena the sound effect was. Cause you know, they all have their like, there's like six or seven ways they do the defense chants and stuff like that. Could I guess what NBA arena it is? Mm. Now I feel like I'm living that because I'm not, it doesn't objectively look to me like a Philadelphia 76ers game. And yet very clearly these are sound effects imported from the Wells Fargo Center. No, it's something, is it something else now?
I think it is the Wells Fargo Center. No,
is it still the Wells Fargo Center? Okay.
It will always be the FU Center to me. When it was the first Union Center, was absolutely the best version of that. That may be the most rebranded arena in the league, but the FU Center in Philadelphia was the most on-brand best name ever. All right. So we are drunk with power. I know I am. Zach, you started it off last year. Why don't you kick it off again? If you could change one thing, do one thing, you are all powerful. You don't have to consult with owners or players or consultants or anybody else. You just get to declare it. What is it?
I'm going to give you two because you've asked me first, and so I'm going to be one of those people who's like, I have a three-part question instead of one question. Number one is play-in tournament is a no-brainer. Let's make the play-in tournament happen.
Absolutely.
Number two, yes. So that's my first one. Let's just make it happen.
Amen.
Number two, 10 games, a 10-game stretch in every season, and there's no clean way to do this because I'm thinking like games 30 to 40, which are different for every team, so there'd be a weird scheduling issue. There should be, or maybe it's 10 days or 2 weeks. I don't know. Everybody uses the Elam ending for 10 days or something like that. Everyone has the Elam ending for 10 days.
Some portion of the season.
Yeah. I think the Elam ending, I think there's a chance that it actually might be a really good idea and it might be better than regular basketball. Not prepared for it to become like the law of the land, but I think it deserves a life outside just the All-Star game.
I like
and
it.
You could do the first month of the season,
yeah,
so that the stakes seemed a little lower, but that it would get people, both fans and players, into
a month is long. A month is long, but a month is long for an intro period. But maybe like the first week of the season, or the second week of the season, or something like that.
I like it. All right, that was two.
I like your two parts. I like that.
Rach, I listen. I mean, fairness. If you've got two. If you got four, you want to just like trump Zach at this point, go for it.
I'm going to stick by some of my points from last year. I'm not going to bore you with rehashing them, but I will say that I'm still very dedicated to them. But I don't know how you would do this, but I do think we need more of a mechanism for it. Right now, there really isn't a way to get an owner out of the league who has shown over time that they are not good for the sport. And I know everyone points to Donald Sterling, but Donald Sterling was really an incredibly artful and long and involved. And if you listen to our friend Ramona Shelburne's extensive podcast last summer about the Sterling affairs,
which was amazing,
it was not as simple as Adam Silver saying he's out of the league. That's not what happened. That they had to enlist Shelly Sterling, that there were a bunch of different dominoes that went, that Donald certainly could have and did at some point start to sue them. And that, you know, again, because of the situation between Shelly and Donald, the NBA was allowed to able to sort of get that sale to happen, and that Shelly is really the one who did the sale. And so the Donald Sterling situation was not that the NBA said, we don't want him in the league anymore, and they got him out. There really isn't a mechanism for that. There is in the rule book, I believe, if 2/3 of the owners vote out the other owner? Is that what it is right now? But I think that there is a huge reluctance on the part of the owners to ever push that button because they sort of feel if it could be me next. And so I do think, and I don't know what it is, and I'd be curious what your ideas are, whether it's just with the way a team has been managed, and you could give it a 20-year period, right? It wouldn't have to be in like a 5-year period or something, but if for 20 years, and I can't think of what team I might be thinking of, Howard Beck, that you might have used to cover, but if there is a team that the
way it's managed.
No, but if they're like, like, there is not a mechanism that if an NBA franchise is being run, and again, I don't mean on a quick trigger, I don't mean that they're having a down few years, but I mean that if there is an owner that is showing over decades or more than a decade that they are not operating with the ethos and best interests of the league, definitely on the in terms of the values that the league operates with, and then also perhaps of the competitiveness that the league wants to operate with, I wonder if there could be some change in the mechanism for the NBA to have more control as a league of who its owners are, because there is a period where they evaluate owners and people trying to buy teams, and it's a few months. And I think that they vet these guys as well as humanly possible, but you can only vet people so much in terms of what they are going to do as owners. And then it's basically been a free ticket. And I just would like to see some other mechanism to have a little bit more control in the league, not just in the hands of the other owners, of who the owners of these teams are. Is there anything you guys can think of that would work?
I thought when you first brought that up, I'm texting my wife to bring me a glass of wine, by the way. Not a good look for me.
I was going to say she is the most overqualified bring you a glass of wine I've ever heard of.
But, no. My wife is the biggest badass that I know, full stop.
Absolutely.
I thought you were bringing this up, Miss Nichols, in conjunction with the WNBA and not the NBA.
Obviously that's one of the issues on the table.
And I was talking to a few WNBA players that I know about Senator Loeffler when this was all happening, and about the players' union saying full out, get her out of the WNBA. And I said, politically, I could not be more sympathetic. However, you are definitely going to run into the issue of the other owners looking around and saying, wait a second. I might have voted for a couple of candidates that the players don't like in my time. And this is the warning that Mark Cuban sounded at, really, frankly, kind of an unpopular time for him to sound it, which is right at the heart of the Donald Sterling thing, was saying this is a slippery slope for us. And I think that's a really interesting issue to dig into, because I think the players are completely justified to say, hold on, this is an 80% black league, and you're saying this? Like, I don't think you should have a part in this league. But it is more complicated than that. It's trickier than that. And the mechanisms are not as easy as the commissioner just saying, bam, you're out. And maybe it should be, maybe it shouldn't be. But I assumed you were bringing, I assumed the impetus for this question was Kelly Loeffler.
Obviously, the principle applies, in both leagues, right, Rach?
It's across the board. Yeah. I mean, the Loeffler thing is the most recent, but there's you know, in both leagues, the idea that the only way an owner can be removed is by, I believe it's a 2/3 vote of the other owners, and that there does not seem to be any desire, even with the Donald Sterling situation, of owners wanting to set a precedent of ousting one of their own. And this is why, if I was the czar of the NBA, I would create some other mechanism, because I do think there is a greater good. And whether it is having an owner that does not represent the beliefs of the players from whom he or she earns her money, I mean, it's not just that, like, doesn't represent them, but you're making money as an owner off of the backs and talent and work and smarts of these men and women. And it is not okay for if there is a collective feeling of this person should not be, this is not who I want to give my time, money, and talent to, given that the fact that this sport has a draft. If we didn't have a draft and players had complete ability to play for whoever they wanted the whole time, then I would say, sure, free market, right? Like, you can be an owner, you can represent these values either ethically or politically or competitively. And if players want to play for you, they can. And if they don't, they don't. That's their choice. But we don't offer players that choice. We draft them and we assign them to different teams for quite some time. And I just think that whether it's ethically or politically, or whether it is competitively over decades, I would like to see a mechanism that's different than just relying on the owners to oust their own. See, I've had three glasses of wine here, because it's not working. It's not happening.
Yeah. And look, even if there were no draft, the fact is there's only X number of teams in any one of these leagues. So at a certain point, even if you thought that's not an owner I want to play for, that's not a franchise that shares my values, you still are limited in how many times you can make that decision, because ultimately somebody has to take their money. Somebody has to go play for them. So I do think it's incumbent, as I wrote last week about the Knicks, the team I used to cover, Rachel, that it is incumbent at a time like this that owners be very clear about what their values are. And I think that they need to be standing with their players. And the fact that the owner of the Knicks, Jim Dolan, has not made it clear what he supports or doesn't. I don't care who he's hired, by the way. And this came through in the story too. And it wasn't me just talking. This was Black agents and Black executives and other people who have far more standing on this issue than I do, saying just hiring people isn't enough. Do you support the Black Lives Matter movement? And not even in capital letters, even in small letters, the idea of it, this push to reform police, this push to create racial equality in a way that this nation has never reckoned with. You're either with the players on this and with African-Americans on this, or you're not. And the Knicks are ambiguous at best on this. And yes, we covered this a little bit last year too on this podcast, which was the idea that you and I, Rach, both brought this up. And mine was, owners should have a 10-year contract. When you buy a team, you got 10 years. And at the end of that 10 years, you've got to be renewed. And that renewal may be based on the other owners, maybe based on fan support, whatever metrics possible. But you're not guaranteed to own it in perpetuity. This is a privilege, not a right. This is not like owning a 7-Eleven. This is a public trust. And there are fans who invest their time and emotional energy in your team. And if you have failed, either in terms of your values or in terms of your competency, and I think that in this case, the person we're talking about has failed on both counts, there should be a mechanism to say at the end of 10 years.
Not just him, though, by the way. It's not just him.
And it's not just him. No. There are plenty of bad owners. We could do an entire podcast about that. Anyway. All right.
Did you mention the DeVos family in your story? I can't remember.
I did not, but I probably should have.
Somebody did in a recent story, and I think that is the one that is – maybe it's because it's Orlando and people don't care. But that was one – look, I'm a couple of drinks in, I'll just say it. Like, before the season, I had two big stories that I wanted to write, and I wanted to travel to write them. And one of them was – and I'm 0 for 2. I didn't get either of them done. One of them was, I want to go to Orlando and write that story because she's the Secretary of Education. Now, she married into the DeVos family so she's not a DeVos, but like that's, I guess that it's just hasn't ever really been explicitly, here's a big story just about this. I mean, that's just sitting there is like, that's a big deal. It's a big deal that family owns the Magic and the political stances that they've taken. And now they're in power, period. I mean, they've always been in power because rich people are in power one way or another, but now they're really in power.
Yeah.
They're in Orlando, I mean, Orlando is the site of the Pulse nightclub shooting, and you could go back on the larger family's views there as well.
We collectively...
But I failed. I didn't get that story done.
Yeah. We collectively, as the media covering the NBA, do not do a good enough job of covering ownership and what owners in this league stand for, how they invest their money, their politics, everything. Like, and just in general, I don't think we spend enough time or enough focus there. Although shout out to Henry Abbott and True Hoop for doing a lot of that. But I think we let them off the hook a lot. All right. From that heavy issue. All right. You guys have both weighed in.
Sorry.
I'm going to lighten the mood just a little bit. I alluded to this on Zach's podcast. I said I was going to bookmark and come back to it. So here it is. MVP ballot, 10 slots.
Oh, Jesus.
We go, come on.
Hold on. Hear me out. We go five deep as it is right now, and there are always some tough cuts. And in this case this year, Zach's got a highlighter marker out now. My God.
I got to take some freaking notes, man.
I don't know what he's about to
do. How cheap do you want to make this race?
No. 10 slots? Listen. Hear me out, Rach. First of all, we always have these tough cuts when we're talking about the four and the five. These are guys that we know. Usually, if you put a guy four or five, you're saying, I don't think they're good enough to be MVP, but I think they had such an impactful and important season that I want to put them on the MVP ballot for recognition. And the difference between being fourth, fifth, or sixth and seventh on a list that we always have to draw a line on isn't that much. And the reason I say go deeper is two things. One, a guy like Chris Paul, who just missed my ballot, I'd feel better if I had a sixth slot and I could put Chris Paul on there and he gets some points. And, there's Basketball Reference totals points for a guy's entire career. There's averages. There are other things, ways that you now know on a given season. Rach, you always talk about when you talk about award reform, you want to know who the best guys were that season. a five-man ballot only gives us a sense of who the top five were. And even though all of us have different three, four, five, and so maybe eight or nine guys get votes, if it goes 10 deep, you have a better sampling amongst the 100 voters of who really were the impactful players. So it satisfies your historical goal. But on top of that, or just as a reference point, Major League Baseball's MVP ballot goes 10 deep, and no one's ever thought, well, that's crazy. And they go 10 points for number one, 9, 8, 7, 6, all the way down. There's no reason we couldn't do this. I don't think it warps the process because we will still have Giannis and LeBron at the top in a year like this. And it will just be more about the recognition that we give to some of the guys who had really impactful seasons but weren't worth the top of the ballot. That's my case.
How about we go 1 to 450? Let's do the full MVP rankings all the way top to bottom. Howard Beck, do you want to give people a participation ribbon in Little League Baseball? Are you part of the participation ribbon culture?
No.
I actually think a 10%. Look,
how about seven?
Who likes to do
seven?
This stuff. I think a 10% MVP ballot could actually be kind of fun. I just did it right now, so I'm excited to do it.
All right, who are your 10?
Well, I already did my top five, which was Giannis, LeBron, Harden, Dame, Kawhi. 6 to 10 would be Luka Doncic, Nikola Jokic, Anthony Davis, Chris Paul, Jimmy Butler. There, did it, done.
See that? And doesn't it feel better knowing that you got those guys in somewhere and they got some points and that amongst 100 voters?
This is
I don't feel any better.
I've known you for decades, Howard Beck. This might be the worst idea you've ever had.
Seriously. I've had way worse. In my defense, I've had way worse ideas than this. There's no question.
My point about knowing who the best player in the league is each year and wanting a better record of that is who the best player in the league is. It's not about who the top 10 participation trophy people are. If you want a snapshot of who the top 10 players in the league are.
I want everyone to get participation trophies in Little League Baseball.
I'm fine with that.
This is not a participation trophy.
They're small children. Let them get a participation trophy and a cookie and a glass of Kool-Aid.
This is not changing who gets the top of the ballot. It's just saying...
Howard, if you want to know who the top 10 players are every year, vote for them for your first and second team All-NBA.
I do.
There are mechanisms for this already. And by the way, quoting, Major League Baseball does this. Of all the days, today is the day you're going to say Major League Baseball. We should follow the path of Major League Baseball.
Rachel, are you attacking? Are you attacking our fine colleagues in the BBWAA? No, the BBWAA controls all of the voting and all the awards structures. You're not attacking MLB. You're attacking our fellow writers in the BBWAA.
I'm not. I actually support MLB's award system or the Professional Baseball Writers Award system in some other ways. And again, by the fact that they don't try to make the MVP award do everything, which I think we do and is a mistake. Right. I would say that top 10. One of the things that bothers me about MVP in general is that we have these discussions, and I guess we all need things to talk about over an 82-game season, about who's in the conversation. This drives me up a wall about, is so-and-so in the conversation at number 4 or 5? They're not going to ever win the MVP, but are they in the conversation? The conversation should be about who could win the MVP. The conversation should not be about who's 4 or 5.
Well, there are only two people in that conversation this year.
Yes.
And most
years. That's the conversation.
To Howard's point, I take...
Sometimes three.
I take 3 to 5 very seriously because I do think it's a big deal for a player to finish. When I go to Basketball Reference and I say, and I look at their MVP finishes and there's a 4 or a 3 or a 5, I'm like, all right, that's a big deal. That guy made enough ballots. But yes, to your point, in the conversation has been used very loosely. Yeah. Lots of people are in the conversation. Really, this year and in a lot of years, there are two people that are in the conversation, and that's Giannis and LeBron, and everybody else is on the fringes lurking somewhere because this is a 5-person, or if Howard Beck gets his way,
they can overhear the conversation. That's what 4 and 5 are. There are people who are overhearing the conversation. And Howard, by the way, the idea that, we have trouble because we have to cut it off at 5, and what about number 6? If you make it 10, you're going to have issues about who's number 11. It's just all-star voting, right?
No.
Where people are upset about the snubs to the all-star starters, and then there's upset about the snubs to the reserves, and then who got snubbed from the snubs.
I think any given year, the top 2 to 3 is the real competition for MVP. And any given year, those 4 and 5 slots actually come down to 5, 6, 7 guys who are deserving in different ways. And if we extended it a little bit past that, we would get a better overall picture year by year of who the best players in the league were. And you as a student of history who says that that is an important thing to note for posterity, I would have thought would have sympathized with that. But that's okay, Rach. You can crap on my ideas.
No, we all hate your idea. We all hate your idea. And it sucks. It sucks just like your curtains. And that's the end of the story.
It's a good.
Can I say, by the way, I actually like your curtains.
Thank you.
They're lovely. I feel like you need to show a picture to the listeners. It'll be on Howard's Twitter.
It will be.
The curtains, I think, are lovely.
It will be. And there are many boxes of things from my past back there, mostly old newspapers. all right. If you guys didn't like that, how about this? I tweeted this yesterday. One last award one. All defense should be three teams. All rookies should be one.
Yes, I'm in there. I'm with that.
Because exactly. All rookie, well, go look back over the history of all rookie. The second team, these are a bunch of like these are nonsense players in a lot of years. There's no reason. We shouldn't be rewarding 10
I'm
rookies.
I'm not going to have you disparage Rui Hachimura and Kobe White like that. I'm fine with 10 rookies being honored. I am also fine with three all defense teams.
Okay.
So I 50% approve your idea.
All right.
And 50% throw it in the toilet.
All right, Zach, what do you got next? We got a few. We should wrap up in a couple minutes here, but let's do a few more. My beer's getting low.
I like some sort of time where we experiment with the G League free throw rule, the one shot for everything rule, one shot like for three, one shot for two. That's interesting. I'm interested. I want to see how that works a little bit. I'm trying to stay away from the obvious ones that we've talked about before, right? So I'm reaching a little bit, but I do think that rule that like there are views that it got in the G League were positive, and I'm interested.
All right.
My next one is a television related one, so it's possible maybe it could happen. Although it's really not up to the TV networks; it's up to the league. So I guess we're back to the commissioner's our position here. I just think the evolution of media has changed, right, in the last 10 years. That if you are a human out in the world, you can have access to athletes, celebrities, in so many ways that there were barrier to entries before, whether it's sitting at LeBron James' dinner table with his family, having tacos, or playing video games with Devin Booker on Twitch and like literally sitting on the couch with him. Or I do not watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians, but I have been informed that you could participate in their bikini waxes in the reality show if you so want to view those, or their children giving birth. So my point is that whether it's Instagram Live or reality TV or Twitch or anything else, that viewers or readers or listeners are used to a level of intimacy 10 years ago. And when the NBA only allows broadcast networks in their wired up segments to have good defense, everybody give their all out there, I think it is doing a disservice to the league. And I'm not saying that there should be an open mic. And I certainly understand why the NBA has someone in our broadcast trucks saying this is okay and this isn't. I think that person should still be there. I don't think that everything said in an NBA court is for public consumption, but it is a sliding scale. It's a sliding scale right now. It's just that slider is way over on one side. And I would like them to move the slider a little bit with the understanding that NBA fans, when they are not watching the NBA and they are consuming other entertainment and other sports, video games, other things, they are exposed to much more of the reality of that experience. And that when the NBA is competing for eyeballs and your balls, that, you know, you need to offer a little bit more of that. So I would like to see a little bit more of that. A camera on the Lakers bench alone this year in the bubble, with a mic there, I think would be fantastic television.
Yeah, I'm generally less interested in like every time there is a camera angle innovation, my reaction is generally like, can I just see the game? I don't need to see this like thing fly. I don't need this like flying around like a bird view of basketball. Just show me the game. But the, you know, obviously as a media person, I'm with you. Like I love to hear the chatter. And I think The Last Dance was, you know, for as artful and long and in depth as The Last Dance was, I think what everybody liked the best was the 30 minutes combined of Michael Jordan unfiltered at practice, right? I mean, that's what's going to stick with people. The counter to that is, you know, the most famous example of what you're talking about from the last 2 or 3 years was when the mics had Steve Kerr telling Kevin Durant the story of Michael Jordan passing to him or to Paxson or whatever story he told. I assume it was to him. And Durant was that caused actual internal drama with the Warriors. So you just never know. Like, I understand the team's perspective of, like, you never know what one of these things is going to screw up our team. That was great television, and with a different set of personalities may have made no difference, may have made no ripple at all, but it made a ripple, right? I mean, like, it made a real ripple.
Yep. But is that something like that? That example is a great example, right? And it's something that is good because it didn't, it's not an inherently embarrassing moment, right?
No, not
it's
at all.
Not something that people would say if it was any person, it would be a bad thing. You shouldn't show that. So it was something that the Warriors were upset about because of the sensitivity of the player, because of some of the drama and side stories around their team for the previous year. And maybe there's room to say that if anything trips that a little bit, we shouldn't show it. Or maybe the answer is, hey, guess what? Your team had two of its players arguing on the sideline in front of everybody. And if that got on TV, we need you to be a little bit less precious about this getting on TV, because at some point, NBA ratings were down last year, right?
My point is that the teams are going to be precious. That's going to be the stage. You're going to have to overcome that, like, absolute preciousness that the teams are going to have. But this is a great opportunity. Like, oh, everyone's like, I don't know, we need a 7-second delay. Do I really want to hear, is it really in the best interest of the league to hear what Joel Embiid is actually saying to these centers? Yes, it is. It is, because, like, there have been games where Joel Embiid has, like, absolutely mentally destroyed Andre Drummond or Hassan Whiteside. And, like, I want to hear everything. I want to hear all of it.
Hell yes. Absolutely. And to Rach's point, something that none of our employers would want us to talk about, the ratings are struggling a little bit, locally, nationally, otherwise. This is among the ways that there's a very easy solution to have people want to tune in.
The competition for ratings isn't just with other sports anymore, right? Yeah. It's with the fact that on your phone, you can get every television show you could possibly want. It's just not on at 9 o'clock on Thursday. It's on anytime you want it in your pocket. You can play video games. There's so many other things competing for the entertainment dollar that to be behind in this aspect of entertainment, to me, is a mistake. And again, that doesn't mean they should have an open mic, but I would just like the slider to slide across a little bit.
You know what I can't get, Rachel Nichols? You know what I can't get on my phone or on my Netflix or on my TV? You know what I can't get? The seasons of the Great British Bake Off that are British TV only. I can't get them anywhere.
Whoa.
They have been described to me as the, quote, holy grail of television.
Wait, hold on.
Great British Bake Off fans, and I can't get them.
All right, my daughter Talia is a huge, huge fan of the show. She's been binging it ever since lockdown, pandemic, all this crap began. She loves this show. Are you telling me that when she runs out of Netflix options, seasons...
That's it. You can't get them.
But there's more that are some secret UK version?
That's correct. There are 7 seasons that you can access in the U.S., and I believe 3 that are, again, have been described to me non-ironically as the holy grail of Great British Bake Off television.
Wow. This is amazing.
Have you been watching?
Have you watched with her?
I poke. So
have you been seduced by the blue eyes of Paul Hollywood?
I've not watched a lot of it. I kind of go in and out. Like, the TV room is in the room next to where I'm sitting right now, where my office is, and so I'll hear it.
Is it on now? Is the Great British Bake Off on now?
No, Talia is actually baking herself right now. She has this nightly thing that they've been doing during lockdown where she and her friends get on FaceTime and they all bake together but apart.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
Yeah, it's cool,
that's
right?
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a few hours ago, she was watching and I was overhearing many British accents fussing over torts and things. So
let me tell you this.
Tell me this.
Rachel, a colleague of ours at ESPN, who shall not be named, is a closet Great British Bake Off fan. I would actually say he or she is a closet super fan of the Great British Bake Off.
Oh, is this not known to the general public?
I don't think so. And he or she will be forced by me to do a weekly Great British Bake Off recap podcast if and when the Great British Bake Off returns.
I have a
hashtag GBBO.
That's amazing.
I have a couple of guesses off the top of my head, but I'll save them. Wow. Well, this is a phenomenal tangent that I did not anticipate.
If you want to go on for 90 more minutes on the Great British Bake Off...
Here's what's amazing. So Zach did a podcast with the people who created The Good Place.
Yes,
and
which
we're
was
also
awesome.
Responsible for
love that right. fucking show, and that was a great pod.
It was an amazing pod. And Zach, can you explain my reaction when you were in LA and explain to me that you did this podcast? How, you've podcasted with all kinds of athletes, coaches, famous celebrities. You podcasted in this case with the people in the writer's room of a television show. And what was my reaction?
Great television.
I went on The Jump that afternoon, or I believe actually the next day. And Rachel said, hey, what'd you do yesterday in LA? How'd you spend your afternoon in LA? And I said, you know, I had Mike Schur and Joe Mandy and Jen Statsky on my from the Good Place, you know, the Good Place people on my podcast. And she reacted like I had had Muhammad Ali back from the dead, Abraham Lincoln back from the dead, and like Al Pacino and Robert De Niro to talk about their scene together in Heat. All on the same podcast.
I don't think that was an overreaction. These are also the people who brought us Parks and Rec and so many amazing shows.
I said,
go ahead.
No, I said, Rachel, they'd be happy to meet you. Any you host a television show, you're a public figure. I think you can get in touch with these people through a lot of different means if you want.
I think Rachel and even lives in LA, if I recall it correctly.
Her reaction was unwarranted, was so over the top.
My answer when Zach said that to me was, there's no way I could possibly reach out to any of those people because it would be too overwhelming for me.
That's true.
Because
she did say that.
It would be too embarrassed. And he was like, just at a Clippers game. Like I can pull Jan or Michael aside. And I was like, I would literally just hyperventilate in the stands if we went over and said hi. The whole reason I bring up this tangent is that I know someone who is an integral part of the production staff of the Great British Bake Off. And I will not say her name on this podcast out of deference to her, but maybe we can talk a little bit about an exchange later, Zach, that maybe if I can pluck up the courage to someday meet Michael or Jen or any of the people associated with those shows that I love so much, I will introduce you to my friend who is an integral British Bake Off producer.
If you introduce us, you need to prepare her for 4 hours of questioning very specific questions about the Great British Bake Off.
Can she also get us some sort of like pirated bootleg stream to see these?
I'm telling you,
these seasons, these golden heralded like secret seasons that Zach's talking. Because my daughter would very much like to watch those because we have a lot of lockdowns still to go, or at least non-school months still to go. All right, I've got one more I'll throw out before we go. I've got my goofiest one, and it's this. It's only semi-goofy. Dwight Howard has not been very pro-mask wearing. There have been some other violations within the bubble. I want the referees to be empowered within the bubble to call technical and flagrant fouls on players who have either not worn their mask, who are getting too close to people, who just empower them to do all the same stuff they do on the court, do it within the NBA campus. And if you get like 6 fouls called on you for non-mask wearing, you're out of the bubble. You're done. You're tossed. Two technicals, whatever the hell that constitutes, you're out. I want Zach Zarba and all these guys, Tony Brothers, just roaming the campus, you know, minding their own business. But they see something going on, boom, whistle, you're out. Foul. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
You've just written an SNL skit. I'm not sure you wrote an NBA reality, but I'd watch it on SNL. I'd watch it with, I think, Beck Bennett playing the referee, of current SNL cast members.
I also think
McKinnon. Kate McKinnon can play anything. It doesn't matter.
Absolutely. Yes. I think NBA fans would be happy to see referees tossing. I think a lot of people would be happy to see Dwight Howard just get tossed for a flagrantly flouting mask wearing and also deciding that vaccinations are somehow bad. Like a lot of people would just like to see Dwight Howard ejected at this point. So
can I give you a 10-second slice of life of referees in the bubble before we go?
Yes.
So I was not familiar with the sport pickleball. Are you guys?
Oh, my mom, who's in her 70s, about 5 years ago, intense pickleball phase. The old people love pickleball. I got a pickleball racket for Christmas one year. So, yes.
You want to explain to people what the pickleball is?
Well, it's just...
It does not involve a pickle?
I don't exactly know what it is. It's some sort of racket sport where...
Right. So, it's sort of like a combination of tennis and paddleball and ping pong, probably, life size, right? Like, it's 4 people who play, or at least that's the version I've been watching here in the bubble. There's a pickleball-sized court that is available in the middle of the area where the NBA officials and media are staying. And pretty much every day, all day, the ringleader apparently is Scott Foster, who is such a pickleball enthusiast that he has an app on his phone when he travels in normal times to find pickup pickleball games. He has become the pickleball leader here, and the referees, as you pass by on your way to get food every day, you will see a bunch of referees playing pickleball all day, every day. It's very impressive.
Well, Rich,
there you go.
Cho,
that's my bubble slice of life.
Rich Cho, the former Hornets GM and Blazers executive, currently with the Grizzlies, I believe, is like a borderline professional pickleball player. I don't think he's there for Memphis, but if he were, he would be wiping the floor with Scott Foster and Scott Foster's mean-looking face. Because Rich Cho can play some pickleball. Google Rich Cho pickleball. You'll see some action shots that will make you be like, oh, that guy is serious. Rich Cho against my 74-year-old mom, mismatch.
This is the inside info that people come to Zach Lowe for. This is phenomenal. I had no idea. Pickleball was something I'd only seen referenced in the last few days of people talking about the bubble. So I'm clueless. More reasons why I cannot be in the bubble. All right, we have gone way long. This has been awesome. And I'm many beers in, including the dual IPA. Double IPA? And feeling no pain. I don't even care about all the crapping that you guys did on my ideas. I'm good at this point. But thank you. This has been a blast. This has been Drunk with Power, an annual tradition, a heralded sacred tradition, I would like to think of it as. And let's hope that next year we're doing this again in Vegas at a tiki bar and not via Zoom.
I'll tell you this. The next time we do this in Vegas, I am getting hammered. The next time we get to do this in person, I'm going all out, because all of us are going to cherish the kind of stuff we get used to take for granted. And wherever we have this in Vegas, it's going to get ugly, and that's going to be fantastic.
Hallelujah. Amen. And other words.
Thank you, Howard and Zach, for hosting us.
Zach, Rach, this has been awesome. Thank you. Be well. Rach, stay safe in the bubble. And I don't know. Maybe we'll all see each other in the finals if we decide to venture that far.
See you guys.
Come down.